Well, grace and peace to each of you as we gather today in this way. It's good to gather. It's good to have present among us Emily Hedrick, who will be sharing with us from the burying God, gathering spices, and healing from spiritual abuse. So there'll be some form of response that I will invite you into as we move through the worship service. So open our hearts and our awarenesses to God present among us.
Thank you, Kevin. And to introduce Emily, Emily Hedrick grew up in southeastern Pennsylvania, near where my roots are. She was a book lover from an early age who fed her appetite with a wide variety of fiction. I like the sound of that. That was me. Later expanding into spirituality and theology. She received her BA in music and Bible and religion from Goshen College and is now a Wake Forest University School of Divinity graduate student. While spending the summer after her sophomore year of college working in the Iona Abbey kitchen off the coast of Scotland, Emily committed some of her spiritual journey to paper. Taking her childhood love of Pilgrim's Progress as inspiration, her writings took the shape of the book True Confessions of a God Killer. Here is a copy, and it exists and is an excellent book, and I would of course say that, but I believe it because I was involved in publishing the book. I was honored to work with Emily through my own publishing venture, Cascadia Publishing House, and would note that if you're interested in a copy of the book, you can buy one from Beverly Delp at the EMS front office downstairs. I hasten to add, given conflict of interest potential, that proceeds go to the EMS Congregational Resource Center. Now, in a recent review of True Confessions, a number of good ones have come out recently. Melanie Springer Mock observes that the title of Emily Hedrick's novel might initially seem problematic, even sacrilegious. What believer would wish to read the confessional work of someone who has killed God, even in fictional form? Yet Hedrick's allegory, I'm sure when you saw that you wondered, okay, where is this going to end up? Yet Hedrick's allegory, subtitled A Postmodern Pilgrim's Progress, is deeply spiritual and well worth reading. Those willing, this is still Melanie speaking, those willing to invest their time in her narrative will be rewarded and will emerge seeing the world and God differently than before. I don't know if you're actually drawing on the book for your presentation, but I know at the level of soul, you will certainly be speaking from some of the deep journeying you have done in the book, and greatly look forward, Emily, to what you share with us this morning.
Mark 15. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews."
There were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem.
When he learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the body to Joseph. Then Joseph bought a linen cloth and taking down the body, wrapped it in the linen cloth, and laid it in a tomb that had been hewn out of the rock. He then rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where the body was laid.
When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And the very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb.
Well, thank you, Michael, for that great introduction. And thank you all for allowing a God killer to come share with you in chapel. A week or two after the event that was the catalyst for my faith crisis, a respected teacher showed me to the section of Richard Foster's book, Celebration of Discipline, that describes the dark night of the soul. I'm certain the gesture was meant to be helpful and instructive. I almost threw the book across the room. I had read the section multiple times, and I wanted it to apply to me so badly. I wanted to be apathetic toward God. I wanted to be struggling to believe, but my belief and passion were as strong as ever, and it made me feel that much more isolated. The pain I was experiencing was not about a lack of faith. It was because I had too much faith, and I knew it put me in danger. I was not apathetic to the relationship with God I had once loved above all else. I was terrified of it. This fear was different than anything I would have expected. I was a Bible nerd my whole life. Some may have described me as over-involved in church, if there is such a thing. Once I had learned the Sunday school answers, I proceeded to learn the deeper than the Sunday school answers Sunday school answers. So I knew about doubt, and I even knew a nuanced version of how to successfully fear God. But no one ever told me about how church could become terrifying. And it was difficult to describe it to those most loyal to church, who thought church was a place of safety and love and good news. So what was this catalyst for my faith crisis? What happened? When I was 17, I walked out of a conversation with my pastor, unable to stop a flow of tears. And when I say unable to stop, I mean it went on for over an hour. And the weird thing was, I didn't feel sad. I couldn't figure out why my body was upset. Granted, we had been talking about why it would be unacceptable for me to preach at my church, but I had known the answer going in. I was a woman, and women shouldn't preach. And I had also known from conversations with my parents and my own reading and scripture searching that actually women can preach. It's just that not everyone knows the good news yet. So on that account, I was fine. But the conversation had turned unexpectedly from women in general to me in particular. And when I walked away sobbing, I was convinced that my large involvement in church had been selfish and sinful, that I was unable to forgive people, and that I was so sinful, I had to have my pastor tell me about it, or else I wouldn't have known. And when I walked away, I couldn't feel the sadness in those unstoppable tears. I was too busy being grateful for my pastor's guidance. For 3 more hours, I was convinced that I was a rebellious woman who needed correction. I couldn't hear God on my own, couldn't think for myself, and needed to defer to the nearest religious authority to tell me who I was and whether or not I was acceptable to God. And I perceived that the nearest religious authority found me unacceptable, and I believed him. So I was unacceptable to God. No wonder I couldn't stop crying. But after 3 hours, the reality hit. If I didn't love God, I wouldn't have believed him. My faith, my identity, my biggest ally had led me like a sheep to mental and emotional slaughter. I had been primed to believe whatever my pastor told me. The words present in our conversation, God, sin, love, forgiveness, combined with my pastor's spiritual authority, made me unable to push back. If I didn't love God, I wouldn't have blindly accepted his evaluation of me. Because while I knew how to think for myself, I was also taught to put God first. And that meant that the words of spiritual authorities were more important and more true than my feelings and experiences. Church was not safe. God was not safe. My pre-programmed mind was not safe. After that realization, my faith became toxic. I couldn't stop asking, what gave his words more weight than my own words, my own emotions, my own experiences? How did my emotional identity disappear for 3 hours? And how do I know it won't happen again? The answer was always, if I didn't love God, I wouldn't have believed him. Suddenly, I was living hypersensitive to the power plays all over our corporate faith practice. I saw every worship service as an opportunity for spiritual authorities to take advantage of me. Every conversation about God was dangerous. Every spiritual song or hymn, a manipulative tool. I no longer took for granted the placement of a pulpit in a sanctuary. Perhaps I stand above everyone else so you can see and hear me better, but there's another subtler message that can settle in unconsciously if we don't actively attempt to negate it. The person in the pulpit knows more about God than everyone who sits below them. There is a hierarchy here. There are power dynamics at play, even or maybe especially in the church. And we reinforce them every Sunday. It took a good 2 years before I could walk into a sanctuary without an increased heart rate. This was no dark night of the soul. It was spiritual trauma, and it came through people I loved and trusted. Spirituality is a powerful resource. It can drive profound social and personal change. It can charge group gatherings with emotional energy. It is at the heart of organized religion. And like all powerful resources, it can be selfishly and often unknowingly misused. The term I found to describe what I experienced is called spiritual abuse, and I define it as when someone with spiritual authority takes advantage of another's spirituality to meet their own needs. This often involves a loss of spiritual identity for the one being abused and is often directly tied to a rigid belief system. The words, "If you truly love God, you'll believe the way I do," coming from a spiritual authority, can do a lot of damage. Those most vulnerable to spiritual abuse are often some of the most eager to please God, because spiritual abuse can't really happen to people who don't care. My negative experiences resulted from intense belief, not gradual decline into doubt. And spiritual abuse is almost always unintentional, or in the very least unconscious, because it's easy to forget the power present in religious authority, especially for denominations like Mennonites who idealize a more equal share of power in the church. But the power dynamics are still there, especially for children and adolescents still developing a mature understanding of God. A great example I encountered when I was in high school, I had a Bible study with some of my friends, and we talked about images of God that we had had throughout our lives, and one of them said, "Well, when I was a kid, I thought that the pastor was God." It's a lot of power, and it sounds a little ridiculous, but it's not completely unfounded. A child's inability to comprehend metaphor and abstract concepts could easily bring her to believe that the person at the pulpit bearing the message from God is God himself. And if that basic understanding is left unconscious and unchallenged, it's easy for it to come into play in later conversations with religious authorities. So speaking of God, where is God in all of this, and how can we prevent spiritual abuse from happening? As future pastors and religious leaders, it's imperative we talk about this, because I'm certain I'm not the only one who has experienced both spiritual abuse and the resulting trauma. And I know I confused many Christians as I struggled along lacking the vocabulary to describe my spiritual crisis, not being able to explain how or why believing in God was terrifying to me. Scripture provides a beautiful image of the struggle for those who are spiritually abused. The narrative of the women watching Jesus' crucifixion. It's subtle and easy to miss, just like spiritual abuse, but the story does show up in one form or another in all four Gospels. Mark's consistent attention to the women throughout the narrative spoke most strongly to me as I read it. We heard in Mark 15, verses 40 through 41, "There were also women looking on from a distance. These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem." So here's the question. What were the women seeing as they looked on from a distance? What did it mean for them? And most importantly, who was God to them in that moment? The scene stood out to me most prominently last year when my theology professor, Frank Tupper, pointed out that Jesus was killed in the name of God. Jesus' claims were considered so blasphemous that he deserved death. And in the midst of our celebrating and arguing over various atonement theologies, we often forget that on Friday and Saturday of what we call Easter week, Jesus' disciples lived with the religious leaders' claim that this man who healed the sick, preached hope for the poor, and the value of those too often forgotten, deserved to die, according to God. As they watched Jesus' supposedly God-sanctioned bloody death, who did these women believe God was? Could they even bear it? While I was still learning how to let myself grieve the loss of my religious innocence, I recognized that the word God, a word I once devoted my life to, had become a destructive word for me because of the abuse I experienced. That's why I told my friends that I killed God. I had to oust the word from my vocabulary because it was no longer working healthily. But the killing may have just been a dramatic gesture on my part. God was dead long before I killed him. In order to heal, I really only needed to accept that the word God had been used violently, and for me, all the life had been sucked out of it. I simply needed to bury it and let it die. It looked like atheism, but it wasn't. In a sense, I was moving, like the women watching the crucifixion, from the cross to the tomb, from Friday to Sunday. Mark writes, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. When they came to the tomb with their spices, I wonder if it was more than their rabbi's body they were laying to rest. I wonder how they described to themselves the whirlwind of Jesus' ministry, their part in it, and its violent demise. Were there arguments about Jesus' validity? About the religious leaders' validity? It's impossible to know what these women were thinking, but we do know that they went to the tomb. It's so easy to forget that the good news of the resurrection starts at a tomb. It starts with the fulfillment of a grieving process. The women brought spices for a corpse, not a living presence. They were willing to admit what had happened, to grieve the violence they had suffered, to anoint the dead body of the man they believed was the Messiah, the anointed one of God, who was killed in the name of God instead. I see myself with these women and their spices, burying their beloved rabbi and Messiah. Because when I killed God, it was much more complex than saying, the word God was used against me, the whole thing is wrong, I'm going to get rid of it. The images of God that had taught me about love and belonging were tied up in the violence of spiritual abuse. In a way, they made the abuse possible because those positive images of God worked and kept me coming back, insisting that God must be good and real because I had experienced that. Yet confusingly, the same word put me in such toxic turmoil. So while a part of me celebrated the newfound freedom of being godless, another part of me was grieving the loving God who had nurtured me since infancy and taught me how to interact with the world and with people. In tears, I too brought my spices to the tomb, ready to anoint the corpse of the God I still loved, even though he was dead to me. This is a different kind of grief than loss of belief, a grief that came on all too strong every time a well-meaning fellow Christian sought to comfort me with words about God. So often I encountered people who told me, "No, Emily, you still believe in God. You love God. You're just going through a hard time." They weren't wrong, but it came to a point where I avoided them. I think the basic assumption in such statements is that not believing in God is the only possible faith crisis a person can have. For me, telling me that I still believed in God or that I would again one day was just rubbing salt in the wound. As I told my friends many times, you have to believe in God in order to kill him. And you have to believe in God in order to say that he's dead. What I needed most from those who sought to comfort me were not people who could tell me about the resurrection, but people who could go to the tomb with me, who would believe me when I said that the word God had died for me and let me grieve. So, what does this mean for us as future religious leaders and current religious leaders? I think one of the most important things we can do for those who have been spiritually abused is to let us bring our spices, to help us mourn the death of whatever image of God was damaged when our spirituality was abused. We have to be able to get to the tomb in order to discover the resurrection for ourselves. We have a unique opportunity to learn how to help people who have been spiritually abused gather their spices and mourn the death of damaged images of God. And it may seem like there's a complicated 5-step process for mourning, but I'd like to suggest something much simpler. The opposite of spiritual abuse. Spiritual empowerment. All those involved in the burial of Jesus were making a spiritually empowered statement. This man is no criminal to be shamefully buried. He will be put in an expensive tomb, and he will be anointed properly. The donation of the tomb by Joseph of Arimathea and the women bringing their spices to care for the corpse are examples of spiritual empowerment. They made their decisions about who Jesus was and what he was worth, regardless of the opinions of religious and political authorities. I imagine the tears they may have wept over their beloved rabbi were their own. They knew how they felt, and they validated it through action. Spiritual empowerment for those who have been spiritually abused means allowing us to tell our story no matter how strange it may seem. Kudos to Michael for letting me write a book about killing God and publishing it. And believing our feelings. At the heart of spiritual abuse is the idea that the victim is wrong and cannot trust themselves. At the heart of spiritual empowerment is the understanding that we are each made in the image of God. We each have our own way of expressing that image that is worth nurturing and listening to, and no one can dictate that to us. We are each the experts in the image of God we carry. Bringing spices to the tomb means not trying to rush to the resurrection. When we as religious leaders are fortunate enough to be trusted with the story of someone whose God has died, we must remember that the discovery of the resurrection isn't ours to control. It's theirs. If we truly believe that we are each made in the image of God, then we can trust that we each have the capacity to encounter God, whether it looks the way I might expect or not. With that in mind, spiritual empowerment looks like allowing others to be where they are without insisting they believe the way we do. It means trusting the journey each of us is on, including ourselves, knowing that we each arrived from a series of events that have faithfully delivered us to where we are. It means trusting that God is at work in each of us, whether or not we call it that or can even stand hearing it. It looks like a lot of listening, a lot of gentle, inquisitive questions, and a lot of space, whether it be time, silence, willingness to ditch church for a while, or the word God, even for something as small as a conversation. Ultimately, it means allowing each person to speak and live her or his story without trying to control it in order to make ourselves more comfortable. I processed my grief with the pastors and spiritual directors who could sit with me and listen to my protests against a God who didn't protect me from spiritual abuse. And they didn't try to tell me better. They believed me. They mourned with me. They helped me rediscover the emotional identity I lost during my spiritual trauma. And most importantly, there was no expectation that I needed to get over it and move on. They allowed me to stay in my grief for as long as I needed and emerge from it changed. As they helped me bring my spices to that tomb, I, like the women, discovered for myself that the stone had been rolled away. God became alive again in new practices and new images, in the healing experiences I had with other Christians who had been hurt by the church but couldn't stay away. I rediscovered the image of God within myself as I relearned how to trust my own emotions and unite them once more with my intellect and my experiences. I saw what we often call God outside of church walls and church language, in the laughter shared by friends, in the artistry of a halved eggplant, in the creativity in the midst of probing questions, in the chaos of not knowing everything and the joy of discovering I don't have to know everything to experience the delight of a barefoot walk in the grass. The resurrected God I met through my own spiritual empowerment, after valued friends and mentors helped me bring spices to the tomb, looks a little bit like the God I was introduced to and loved as a child, but is so much bigger and ever-present than the God I grew up with that was used to take advantage of me. Because my trusted friends and mentors let me experience the resurrection for myself, I no longer see myself as a victim, but as a survivor, blessed with a sacred journey toward wholeness in both myself and my descriptions of whatever it is we've been trying to call God. We need not be afraid of mourning, of those who cannot stomach the word God or the beliefs that often accompany it. Instead, we can empower each other by gathering our spices and waiting, knowing that the gospel could not have emerged without a trip to the tomb.